aleudare.
But strikes are not made with words. Such things are not announced. The missiles will speak for themselves.
The U.S. lifts restrictions on how the Ukrainian military can use American weapons as time runs short for Ukraine to improve its position on the battlefield. A look at where the war with Russia stands now and how the Ukrainian people are persisting. We're the leading voice in the Ukrainian Catholic Church. We speak to a family member of a Hamas hostage who met with the Pope just last week. From her, the latest developments on a potential hostage release and how the families are holding out hope for their loved ones' safe return.
We live on a farm and we have to take care of it, and there's chores that need to be done.
And we visit a Catholic boys' school in Kansas that uses a unique blend of classical education plus farm work to turn boys into responsible and faithful Catholic men. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
Without any unnecessary details, Ukraine has long-range capabilities, including domestically produced long-range drones. We have long-range Neptune and more than one. And now we have Attackums as well. And we will be using all of that.
After months of lobbying, Ukraine can now use American long-range missiles in Russian territory. For the Ukrainians, it's a welcome, though delayed, update in policy from the United States as the war continues to drag on. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. This week marked 1,000 days since Russia invaded Ukraine, sparking a brutal war between the two nations. Ukrainians commemorated their fallen soldiers on the 1,000th day, even as the conflict enters a new phase. To mark the somber milestone, dozens of residents and Ukrainian servicemen gathered in the Ukraine's capital of Kyiv on Tuesday. In honor of those killed in the war, they lit 1,000 candles under the city's iconic Motherland Monument. As Russia shows no signs of letting up and an exhausted Ukraine faces numerous setbacks, will the U.S.'s new weapons policies shift the war, or is it too little, too late? Early Tuesday morning, the Ukrainian military struck an ammunition depot in southwestern Russia with long-range missiles. After more than 1,000 days of war, it's the first time Ukraine has used the American-made weapon outside of its own territory. The Army Tactical Missile System, called Attackums, can hit targets up to 190 miles away.
It's a small one, but it has essentially, in layperson's term, it's a bigger bang. It's also coming down as a ballistic missile, you know, a difficult angle and at very high speed. And it is also precision guided.
The Institute for the Study of War says more than 225 known military targets in Western Russia, like logistical hubs and munitions depots, are in range of the Attackums.
And it's one of the most lethal weapons that the U.S. has in its arsenal. And if the Ukrainians can use it, the same way that the U.S. would use it in a similar situation, then it could very much change the way in which the war is being fought right now.
Ukraine has asked the United States for these weapons since the early days of the war, but its ally refused out of concerns of escalation. Last year, the White House agreed to send hundreds of Attackums to Ukraine, but on the condition that the country only uses them for defense on its own land. Zelensky has spent months asking for permission to use the missiles in Russia. So what made President Biden finally relent on the policy? Many analysts point to the setbacks Ukraine has experienced on the front lines.
The way to think about this is both sides probably can't sustain this war at its current tempo and cost. Yeah, but Russia can sustain it a bit longer at the moment.
Though it has not accomplished its goals, Russia has advanced a mile a day in the southern Donetsk region, its fastest pace since the early months of the war. In Ukraine, faltering recruitment and low morale only exacerbate the struggle against Russia's unrelenting pressure. Cedric Layton, retired Air Force colonel, says the final push for a policy revision came last month when thousands of North Korean soldiers arrived in Russia to help on the front lines.
What the Biden administration is signaling is that that kind of addition to the Russian war machine is unacceptable to us. We don't want foreign troops coming into Russia, supporting the Russian war effort. And the North Koreans are the first ones to do this overtly, at least.
Ukraine fired its first round of attackums in Russia just 2 days after the policy change, though Russia says the facility targeted sustained no damage. In response, the Kremlin intensified its threats and lowered its official threshold for using nuclear weapons.
The president mentioned this several times. If long-range missiles are going to be applied from Ukraine into Russian territory, it will also mean that they are operated by American experts, military experts. And we will be taking this as a qualitatively new phase of the Western war against Russia, and we'll react accordingly.
Despite these threats from Russia, a lame duck Biden is doing everything he can in his last months on the job to provide support for Ukraine before President-elect Trump enters the White House and possibly changes course on the United States' support for the nation. Just days after relenting on attackums, Biden also authorized delivery of controversial anti-personnel landmines, as well as another $275 million in security assistance to Ukraine. Many analysts say the aid comes too late.
They will make a difference. Every successful strike does. But I think the maximum effectiveness of these type of systems has probably passed.
Dara Masiko, senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, says the attackums can provide some relief to Ukraine's forces.
I think what it will allow the Ukrainians to do is take some of that pressure off Russia's on-the-ground offensive or counteroffensive that they are initiating right now. But ultimately, I don't know if the numbers supplied to the Ukrainians is enough to really give them full breathing space up there in Kursk.
In response to Ukraine's use of both American and British missiles capable of striking deeper into Russia, the Kremlin, for the first time, fired a new intermediate-range ballistic missile at Ukraine on Thursday. These are images of the missile debris from the attack on the city of Dnipro. The experimental missile is capable of carrying either conventional or nuclear warheads, but was not loaded with a warhead this time. The Pentagon confirms the U.S. was notified ahead of the launch through nuclear risk reduction channels. Joining us now to discuss these latest developments and to share the voice of the faithful in Ukraine is Archbishop Boris Gudziak, Archbishop of the Ukrainian Catholic Archeparchy of Philadelphia. Your Excellency, thanks for joining us. This week marked 1,000 days since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. I first just want to get your reaction to this somber milestone.
There's great pain and great wounds in our people, in our church. At the same time, there's great gratitude. Most observers internationally, and particularly Putin, thought Ukraine would fall in a matter of 3 days or 3 weeks. And now, 3 years later, the people still stand, keep standing, defending their God-given dignity, their freedom, their democracy. And so it is a time of mourning. Hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. Over 60,000 people have amputations. 15,000 miles of roads have been destroyed. 4,000 schools, 2,000 hospitals, millions, 14 million people displaced. So there's great suffering, great trauma, which will be lasting. But there is also the sense of courage and gratitude for God's graces that Russia has not occupied all of Ukraine and that the country is still free.
And what was a major development this week? With about 2 months left in office, U.S. President Biden authorized the first use of U.S.-supplied long-range missiles by Ukraine for strikes inside of Russia. From your perspective, how significant of a development is that?
Well, I'm not a military expert, and I want peace and a just peace, and that's what all Ukrainians want, first of all. But as long as Putin continues a genocidal war, it's important to be able to defend yourself. You know, if you go into a subway and see some old lady being beaten up, you're going to go defend her. And that's the basic reflex in Ukraine. It's just that simple. They don't want anything Russian. They don't want anything from the Russians. Just leave us alone. Let us live. Let us breathe. And the problem has been that the help for Ukraine has been kind of partial. Well, we'll help you not lose, but we don't really want you to win. And we will dictate in this boxing match that you will not be able to use your left arm. It's going to be tied behind your back. And we're actually going to announce that before the next round. So it's been, a lot of people have died because Ukraine has not had the instruments to protect itself. Mm. And it needs to protect itself because Russian occupation is equivalent to genocide and war crimes, as history has shown and as the last 3 years have demonstrated. Mm.
As you well know, here in the U.S., we're in the midst of this presidential transition. Can you give us a sense, how are Ukrainians feeling about President-elect Donald Trump's upcoming term in office? And do you have a message for the president-elect as it relates to future action he might take on Russia and Ukraine?
Well, I had a chance to chat very briefly with President Trump before the election, and I encouraged him to go there immediately. And I think if he went now before the inauguration, for example, with a group of religious leaders on a humanitarian mission, he would see for himself what is happening on the ground. It is very difficult for us to understand, what's going on in Indonesia, China, in Peru, because we don't know it. We don't see it. Mm. But everybody that has gone to Ukraine, cardinals, political leaders, humanitarian workers, people who were skeptical, people that knew a lot, all came out knowing much, much more and understanding more deeply what's happening. So I would encourage President Trump to go to Ukraine. That would be a news story. We know he likes news stories. But I think much more importantly, it would be a base on which to build a policy for the future.
Can you share, did President-elect Trump seem receptive to that invitation to travel to Ukraine?
He listened. I must say he was attentive. There were 1,400 people in the room. It was at the Al Smith dinner. So it was not the place for, a long, calm interchange of ideas. Mm-hmm. But I wrote him a letter about it afterwards. And I've shared this hypothesis with certain leaders in the church, and they all think it's a good idea. Mm.
Well, we'll continue to monitor that. Your Excellency, you frequently travel to and from Ukraine. Can you give us an update as to how the faithful in Ukraine are holding up? How are our Catholic brothers and sisters doing there?
So it's important to know that in eastern Ukraine, where the Russians have occupied parts of three regions, the public life of the Catholic Church has been virtually extinguished. There's no Ukrainian Catholic priest functioning there now, and a couple of priests who were abducted and tortured for 18 months, who were freed in the summer, they show the scars of what Russian captivity is like. For Catholics, it should be clear that Russian occupation means the extinguishing of our normal church life. And that has been happening for 300 years during different periods of Russian colonization and imperial growth. So Catholics are staying together. Bishops and priests are in place, serving the people, celebrating the sacraments, announcing the good news, but also very much engaged in humanitarian work. Mm. helping those that have lost their homes, their possessions, distributing clothing, food, fostering medical care, Caritas, which is Catholic Charities of Ukraine. There's a Eastern Catholic and Roman Catholic Caritas organization, and they are doing tremendous work. Mm. Very importantly, the church reminds people of their God-given dignity, the fact that the Lord is with them, that every hair on their head is counted, that we have lived through even more harrowing experiences. During World War II, between the Nazis and the Soviets, 6 to 7 million residents of Ukraine were killed, and the whole country was devastated. Ukrainians know they've lived through the crucifixion and have resurrected in the past. So the church announces this Paschal Kerygma. We carry our cross, and God will give us life.
Amen.
Very important for the people of Ukraine.
Absolutely. Your Excellency, we thank you for joining us and for bringing us the voice of the people in Ukraine as well. Archbishop Gudziak, thank you.
I want to thank all the people for praying, advocating, staying informed, and for helping. Please continue.
Amen. We'll keep up those prayers. Archbishop, thank you.
A tragic anniversary for the victims and for the destruction it caused. But at the same time, it is a shameful disaster for humanity.
Pope Francis marked the 1,000 days of war in Ukraine on Wednesday at his general audience, where he asked the faithful to remain close to the martyred Ukrainian people. In the front row in St. Peter's Square was First Lady of Ukraine, Olena Zelenska. The two held a private meeting earlier that morning and exchanged gifts. Later that day, Cardinal Matteo Zuppi, the papal envoy for peace between Ukraine and Russia, offered a special mass for peace in Rome, praying for what he called an end to the madness and a commitment to lasting peace. Pope Francis is calling for an investigation to determine whether Israel's attacks in Gaza meet the legal definition of genocide. That's according to a new book released this week based on interviews with the pontiff ahead of next year's Jubilee year. In September, he said Israel's attacks in Gaza and Lebanon have been immoral and that its military has gone beyond the rules of war. The book's author says the Pope is not taking a stance on whether genocide is happening, but rather is emphasizing the importance of an investigation and thorough analysis by jurists to see if the situation qualifies as genocide under United Nations standards. Outrage in Israel after the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former defense minister for alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza. The warrant might not result in Netanyahu's arrest and trial, but could deal a major blow to Israel's global standing. The court also issued a warrant for the arrest of Mohammed Deif, a Hamas leader who played a crucial role in the October 7th attacks. Israel says he was killed in an airstrike last month, but the court could not verify his death. This week, the Gaza Health Ministry claimed the death toll in the Gaza Strip has surpassed 44,000 people. During the 13-month war, the ministry has never distinguished between civilian and military combatant deaths in its count, but it has said more than half of the fatalities are women and children. It says the real toll is much higher because thousands of bodies are buried under rubble. Of course, that death toll in the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, all sparked by the Hamas terrorist attack on Israel on October 7th of last year that claimed 1,200 innocent lives. Next, a conversation with the relative of one of the more than 200 hostages captured by Hamas about a hostage family's meeting last week with Pope Francis. And later, a lighter note as we talk about the joy of adoption along with some challenges with Catholic psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi.
Our goal is to empower and to feed the faithful so that they can then bring that message to others.
We sit down with the new head of communications for the U.S. Bishops Conference to find out how he plans to evangelize to the next generations. And we go down on the farm in Kansas, a farm run by a Catholic boarding school, that is, as it uses nature to teach boys how to become good and faithful men.
As hard as it is, as expensive as it is, we need to make a deal to bring everyone back. That should be the most important thing in our lives today.
A deal is needed, and it's needed now. That's the message former hostages who were held by Hamas and relatives of others still in captivity brought to the Vatican last week. Pope Francis received them for an emotional meeting where they shared personal stories and asked for his support in bringing the remaining 101 captives home. One of the family members who met Pope Francis last week was British-Israeli filmmaker Sharon Lifshitz. Both of her parents were taken by Hamas on October 7th of last year. Her mother, Yoheved, was freed 17 days later, but her 84-year-old father, Oded, remains in Hamas's captivity. To share her father's story and her experience meeting Pope Francis last week, Sharon joins us now from Tel Aviv. Sharon, thank you so much for joining us. First, can you tell us about your father, Oded? What do you want us to know about him, and what's the latest information you have on him?
The latest information is a year old. We know he was alive in Gaza when he arrived there. He was injured in his hand when the terrorists attacked my parents' home. But he survived it miraculously, and he was in Gaza alive. Since then, we don't know. My father spent a lifetime working for peace among nations. He spent a lifetime caring for the weaker people in society, for dignity for all, for Palestinians and Israelis, for a future for our kids from both sides. My father is 84. My mom is 86. Pope Francis is 88. Mm. I came with my mom to the Pope to ask him to help us, both in action and in prayer, to bring back our loved ones home. Mm.
Was that your main message to Pope Francis last week when you met with him at the Vatican?
Absolutely. It was incredibly emotional and moving to meet the Pope. He is a Pope I greatly admired as a person for a lifetime of working for very similar causes to my parents, who are peace activists, actually. Mm-hmm. And so I felt there was a huge affinity between him and my mom. He knows who my mom is. He knows what she stands for. And I think they really share an outlook about the importance of looking after all of us together. And I think he really connected with the plight of my father and the other 100 hostages. I think he also feels very strongly towards the suffering of Palestinians. And I think this is not exclusive. You can feel incredibly heartfelt emotions towards both sides.
Are there any other details you can share with us from that meeting? Did Pope Francis say anything specific that stood out to you in particular?
He said a few things, but for me, maybe the most emotional moment was towards the end, when he suggested that we all sit calmly together and pray, each in his own way. And I feel sometimes there's been so many words said over the last 412 days, and the pain somehow is there. And sometimes in the silence and sitting with him in prayer for a minute or two, there was maybe more was passed. Mm. He really wanted to make sure we know how much he cares. He really wanted to know that he thinks about us and pray for our loved ones every day. Mm.
And Sharon, just days after your Vatican meeting, there was an excerpt from a new book by Pope Francis that was released. And in this book passage, Pope Francis calls for an investigation to determine whether Israel's attacks in Gaza constitute a genocide. These comments, they've drawn sharp criticism this week, and I wanted to give you a chance to react as well. Did you hear about this, and were you surprised by these comments?
I think, I think the word genocide is a big one. I think the tragedy of the Palestinian people has as much to do with Hamas and what Hamas has done to its own people. The way Hamas has used its own population as human shields is heartbreaking. all of us that believe in the sanctity of life, in the possibility of people for redemption in a way, are heartened by what is happening. I don't know if the word genocide doesn't move away from what really is happening, which is that the Hamas itself is ready to sacrifice so many of its own people to put its infrastructure within civilian infrastructure, within churches and hospitals and mosques and schools, and that they were ready to commit such an atrocity. You know, 57 people of my kibbutz were murdered on that day. 77 were taken hostage, including very, very elderly people, including my parents. This is not an action of somebody who believes in life. This is the action of somebody who absolutely want to draw the utmost hate from the other side. I so regret that our conflict has gone so low now, that murders of women and children in Israel on the 7th of October is kind of becomes just something that we can get over. I also regret that we have not reached a ceasefire and a peace agreement before. My parents have worked a lifetime for a real peace agreement. And I think my father always said that, you know, you make a peace with your enemies, and that war is the failure to make agreements in the end. We are living through the absolute atrocity my parents have spent a lifetime trying to prevent.
Speaking of calls for a ceasefire and hostage negotiations, Sharon, here in the U.S., we are preparing for the incoming Trump administration. Do you have a message for the president-elect when it comes to bringing the hostages home?
Bring them home. Bring them home. Winter is coming. They're in dire straits. They've been there 412 days. They are hardly surviving as it is. Bring them home. This is the only way to finish this war and make a deal so that we can withdraw from Gaza, that Gaza, the people of Gaza, can start looking for a future without Hamas, that gives them the options to raise the children with dignity and with love. And we would slowly then build bridges. They are our neighbors. They're going to stay our neighbors at the end of this war. I want them to be living in peace next to us.
Sharon, be assured that we join our prayers with yours. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. The Vatican confirmed that Blessed Carlo Acutis and Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati will be officially named saints during the year of the Jubilee. Both soon-to-be saints are beloved by young people around the world for their beautiful witness to the faith. Carlo Acutis, the first millennial saint in the Catholic Church, was an Italian computer coding teenager who died of cancer in 2006 at the age of 15. He will be canonized during the Jubilee of Teenagers on Sunday, April 27th in St. Peter's Square. And Pier Giorgio Frassati, an avid mountaineer who dedicated much of his time to care for the poor and for the homeless, died from polio at the age of 24 back in 1925. His canonization mass will take place during the Jubilee of Young People in late July to early August 2025. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. The latest from the presidential transition tops the Week in Review. President-elect Donald Trump continues to solidify his picks for his cabinet and other top government positions. The list is vast, and confirmation hearings for nominees will begin in early January, after the 119th Congress is seated, but before Mr. Trump is inaugurated on January 20th. We will not know the final makeup of his cabinet until then, but one item of note from this past week. Trump's first controversial pick for the all-important role of Attorney General, Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz, is now off the table.
because he has been under investigation by the House Ethics Committee for alleged sexual misconduct with a minor. Gates was a highly contentious nominee from the get-go. It took just 8 days for him to withdraw his name from consideration when it became clear he would not have the votes in the Republican-controlled Senate for confirmation. Within hours of the Gates development on Thursday, Trump announced his second pick to lead the Justice Department. Former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi will now go through the nomination process. Bondi is considered a longtime Trump loyalist who served on his defense team during his first impeachment trial. In his final summit meeting with world leaders, President Joe Biden traveled to South America, ending his six-day trip at the G20 summit this week in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. The leaders of the 20 countries with the world's biggest economies issued a joint declaration calling for a global pact to combat hunger, more aid to war-torn Gaza, and an end to hostilities in the Mideast and Ukraine. President Biden made an urgent appeal to fellow world leaders to surge money to developing nations to help curb climate change and advocated for a series of climate and development initiatives. But many would require buy-in from President-elect Trump, who has called the climate crisis a hoax. President Biden is pressing Congress to pass a billion-dollar aid package he proposed this week, providing relief to Hurricane Helene and Milton storm victims in southeast U.S. Of that, the president is asking for $40 billion to help replenish FEMA's budget, its aid funding drained by this year's active and powerful Atlantic hurricane season and wildfires out west. Leadership on the Hill has signaled that providing disaster aid is a priority. There are just a few weeks left on the legislative calendar, but there is a recognition on both sides of the aisle that getting aid passed is needed quickly. A state judge in Wyoming on Monday ruled the state's two pro-life laws are unconstitutional. One law limited all abortion with exceptions for the life of the mother and in cases of rape or incest. The other law, the first of its kind in the nation, explicitly banned the use of abortion pills. Enforcement of the laws had been temporarily halted while the court case proceeded. Wyoming's attorney general promised to appeal the ruling and send it to the state Supreme Court. A packed courtroom in Hong Kong for the national security trial of former newspaper publisher Jimmy Lai, who testified Wednesday in his own defense for the first time since his prolonged trial began in January. Lai is a well-known Catholic in international circles admired for his pro-democracy views. Lai, who will turn 77 in 2 weeks, has been held in solitary confinement since his arrest in 2020 and was brought to the courthouse in this van under tight security. His arrest came 4 years ago during a crackdown on mass pro-democracy protests that rocked Hong Kong. The media tycoon is fighting charges of colluding with foreign countries, including the U.S., to endanger China's national security and of conspiring to issue seditious publications. In 2019, Lai met with then Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo during a visit to Washington. But in testimony on Wednesday, said he did not ask them to take action against China or Hong Kong and denied he had committed sedition. Wall Street Journal columnist William McGurn is Jimmy Lai's friend and his godfather in the Catholic Church.
This today is the first time we've heard from Jimmy. The trial began in January. This is the first time we've heard his voice. And the government hates that because Jimmy's obviously sincere. He's very charismatic. He's a real champion of freedom. And ordinary Hong Kong people appreciate that.
If convicted, Lai faces a sentence of life in prison. There have been multiple attempts to broker his release from prison. And before his re-election this month, then-candidate Donald Trump said, quote, 100%, I will get him out. Lai's appearance in court on Wednesday came one day after 45 other Hong Kong democracy activists were sentenced up to 10 years in prison under the national security law. Pope Francis has appointed U.S. Cardinal Kevin Farrell to oversee, quote, new and unavoidable reform to the Vatican's pension fund after years of poor planning and management. In a letter to the Roman Curia on Thursday, the Holy Father said the fund faces a serious prospective unbalance and named Farrell the sole administrator of the fund. Pope Francis has pushed for Vatican financial reform since his election in 2013. He believes the pension fund is a critical part of that reform. how to evangelize to the next generations of American Catholics, drawing more young people into the church. That was the question we posed to the new chairman of communications for the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Bishop William Byrne of Springfield, Massachusetts, sat down with our Mark Irons at the conclusion of last week's fall bishops meeting. Here is Bishop William Byrne on the record.
Bishop William Byrne, thank you so much for joining us here.
Thanks, Mark, for having me. It's great to be here.
I want to start with a very basic question, and that is simply for those that may have no idea, what is the Catholic Church? What do we mean by the Catholic Church? Is it just an institution led by bishops?
Right. So it is an institution led by bishops, yes, of course, but it's something more profound than just an institution. It's the mystical body of Christ. He ascended into heaven, and in doing so, he sends forth his spirit so that we then all become his messengers throughout the world. But he gives us St. Peter and then his successors, the popes, to be the unifying force as the vicar of Christ in the world. And then together we are the voice of God speaking that message of truth, that God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten Son. And that Son took all the hatred, all the ugliness, nailed it to a cross within himself, and then he resurrected from the dead and emerged victorious. And now we're all part of that flow of the resurrected life of Christ in the world.
What role do the laity have in this? Because maybe there's a misunderstanding. There might be someone in the pews who says, sharing the faith, transmitting the faith, that's not my job.
Right.
That's up to the priest. That's up
right.
to the bishop. What do you say to that person?
Right. Well, the reality is that I preach from a pulpit, but I'm not in your dining room. I'm not in your classroom. I'm not in your boardroom or wherever you find yourself during your day, around the table with your family at Thanksgiving time. And so our goal is to empower and to feed the faithful so that they can then bring that message to others. And so I always say in my confirmations, I say to the kids, if I showed up at your high school and I was dressed in my bishop outfit and I knocked on the door, your public high school, of course, and I knocked on the door and said, I want to come talk to these kids about Jesus. What should your principal do? And they all kind of stared dumbly at me. And I said, they should call the police. It's not my word. And I'm armed. I hold up my crozier because that's their world. That's where they are. And they're going to be the most effective evangelizers of their peers. But they can't do that if they're not well-fed themselves.
You are now the chairman of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops Committee on Communications. For those that don't know, what is this U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and why should they care?
So there's the body of bishops around the world. And then each nation, or sometimes their groups of regions, will have a conference of bishops where the bishops meet, discuss ideas. It's sort of like the best practices. How do we come together? How do we present a unified voice of most effectively bringing the message of salvation to the world, in particular to our local world and to our local church, and meeting the needs, being able to pivot. The issues in North America are going to be radically different than the issues in other parts of the world. And so we need to be able to adapt to bringing that message to the world.
Why do you think your brother bishops elected you to be head of the Committee of Communications? And what do you hope to bring in this role? Good question.
That's a great question. I think only the Holy Spirit knows it. But somehow I ended up as the chairman of communications. And I think this is a really great opportunity for us. Very often we've been very document heavy, producing amazing statements and documents and teachings, applying the gospel to the local circumstances. But people aren't sitting, if you walk through the airport, they're not all sitting there reading their documents.
Reading the 30-page doc.
They're thumbing on their phones and they're watching videos. And so this gives us an opportunity to pivot it yet again, to bring the gospel into social media and into the different forms of communication, of which especially our young people are encountering their information and to a sad extent, community. So our goal, I think, is always not to have people on their phones, is to get off your phones and to go live a life, but a way of reaching them is to find that going into the marketplace of social media and the internet and places like
that. Absolutely. I want to ask you about that. We think about the tools we have at our disposal to share the gospel. Social media is a big one, as you say. Is it helpful? Is it harmful?
Right. Well, I mean, I think it's just like anything. You know, you can, a glass of wine is a, Paul says it's good for your stomach, and it's a lovely gift. But five bottles of wine is not necessarily a good idea.
It's not going to end well.
No, it's not going to end well. It's not going to have an end story. And so in and of itself, it really is basically a neutral, but it's a tool, just like any tool. And so our goal is to use it most effectively, not to worship it, not to get stuck in it. Our goal is to allow it to help us reach people that otherwise we're not going to be, aren't coming to church, aren't necessarily looking for us, but we can look for them, just like our Lord does time and time again.
In your time, what have you found to be most effective when trying to communicate the gospel?
Well, I've always found joy to be a very effective tool. You know, as the Evangelii Gaudi, as the Holy Father said, it is the joy of the gospel. And what do we need now in this age where there's so much anxiety, there's so much stress, depressive experiences in people's lives, the news you read every day, we're just getting waves of it. It's hard to catch our breath. And so we need to be able to bring the fact that Jesus has brought us so that his joy might be in us and that joy might be complete. So I think joy is one of the most powerful and beautiful gifts that we can bring people, and the most effective way of communicating just who our God is and how much we are loved.
But what do you hope to say when you look back on your time in this role?
It's funny, when I was in seminary, Mother Teresa came to visit. And we all lined up, and she signed our breviaries, and she was just signing people and looking and smiling. And I got in line, and Mother Teresa stopped. I didn't know her. She looked up at me, and she said, "Don't get in God's way." She signed my breviary, and I went away. She didn't say that to anybody else. So my goal is not to get in God's way. That's Mother Teresa said to do it, so that's my primary goal.
That's great advice. Bishop William Byrne, thank you so much for taking
the time. Thanks, Mark. Good to be with you.
EWTN News in Depth will be right back.
Persistence in the arduous good and a taking of responsibility every single day in all aspects of these young men's lives.
The philosophy of a unique Catholic boys' high school in Kansas. Next, we visit St. Martin's Academy to see how work on the farm plus rigorous classroom studies are providing a new model of education for the next generation.
It's been a little over a year now since Pope Francis published his apostolic exhortation on man's relationship with the environment, a follow-up to Laudato Si called Laudato Deum. In it, the Pope speaks of what he calls a healthy ecology and the interaction between human beings and the environment. Well, there's a boarding school in the southeastern corner of Kansas immersed in nature that's putting that into practice. Reporter Alan Holdren tells us it draws on hands-on activities and medieval education techniques to give boys a deep understanding of God's word and God's creation.
The wooded hills of southeast Kansas are home to a relatively new 9th to 12th grade Catholic boys' boarding school, St. Martin's Academy. For going on 7 years, it has combined classical academics with a working farm, where the students do much of the work and are free to be boys.
The Benedictine motto of Ora et Labora really it sets the tone and the rhythm of life here.
They've got daily chores, daily mass, classes 4 days a week, and they dedicate 1 day a week to other projects. No computers, televisions, or cell phones are allowed here.
They want an adventure. They don't want to be sitting down looking at a screen. They want to be in motion, and they want challenges. They want obstacles, and they want to tackle those things together.
Battle for Phoenix, dude. Oh my God.
In a lot of ways, we see our role here at the school as being preparers of the soil. We have to get the soil right. God is the farmer, and these boys, these seeds, they need rich soil to grow in.
Founder Daniel Kerr turned his family farm into an educational institution. Tuition is $25,000 a year per student. They call this a medieval education, immersed in nature.
God is immanent. He is present in his creation. And we are meant to engage him in his creation through our senses. And so we set our boys up so that they're in nature as much as possible. And then beyond that, poetry, music, stories, these are the things that are meant to fill a healthy imagination.
The vision of the school is perhaps best on display during its annual celebrations of the November the 11th Feast of St. Martin, an ancient feast known as Martinmas.
The boys actually put their own hearts and souls into it, and so as that, it makes you have more gratitude towards this, the gift that you're given, the gift that you've worked towards, that your own hands have had a part in making, and you get to see the work and the beauty of God's creation come through from the animals every day to the table, and then get to enjoy that with friends, good friends, family, and brothers.
Fittingly, not only do they prepare the banquet for their patron saint's feast day, but they serve it, and family members come from all over the country to share in the feast, just as they share the St. Martin's educational vision for their children.
The whole idea is that they want to inculcate wonder, you know, which is the font of wisdom, as sacred scripture tells us. So we wanted that for our boys, just to be able to have this great love for learning, just wed it to the real, to nature, and to hopefully have that inkling, that curiosity develop into a love of God and a love of his church.
He's surrounded by other young men that are trying to live the faith well and are really all in on the message and the theme of the school. For him, kind of cemented what we were already trying to build. It kind of reinforced it for him, and brought it to life, and has helped him to mature as a young man, spiritually and physically and academically, just across the board. It's been great.
The students are all in, and not just for the homegrown, homemade food. A condition to their being here is that they have to want to be here, and you quickly see what a difference that makes.
This is not a college prep school, but I would say it is a life prep school because it forces you to be able to manage those things that you want to be good at. You're in a bunkhouse with all your friends 24/7, and it's very easy to just hang out with them if you want, and it's very real to have to separate yourself and get some studying done if that's what you want.
Like, one of the greatest things about the school in my eyes is like just the spiritual life and like the opportunity for like growth. Like, I mean, the chapel is like right there. Jesus is always there. I mean, it's just so nice. Like, we have Mass every day, confession, weekly holy hour. It's just really great for a spiritual life.
Take some notes. I want you to take a quick
The school
note.
Is full to its 65-man capacity. There's an incredible buy-in for this model, where the right relationship with the Creator and creation is at its core. At St. Martin's Academy near Fort Scott, Kansas, Alan Holdren, EWTN News In Depth.
The school is popular. Next year's incoming freshman class is already full. And though just 7 years in existence, St. Martin's Academy is already the twice defending Kansas State champions in rugby.
Next, a family of 10 children, enough to man a sports team of their own. As we celebrate National Adoption Month, we talk to the father of this brood, Catholic psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi, about the joys of adoption.
Welcome back. Every November marks National Adoption Month, a chance to acknowledge families blessed by the gift of adoption and to raise awareness of the need for both foster and adoptive families. To discuss this next topic, our guest brings us both his personal and professional lens on adoption. EWTN's own Dr. Ray Guarendi of The Doctor Is In radio show and Living Right with Dr. Ray television program is a Catholic clinical psychologist who is also an adoptive father of 10 children. Dr. Ray, it is so good to have you. And I'm sure we could speak at length about your family's own personal adoption journey. But do you mind first summarizing how you and your wife discerned to adopt 10 children at that?
I came home from Cleveland Clinic. They said, if you have children conceived, go on TV talk shows. Well, Catherine, in sort of a way, I am on a TV talk show with you guys. So, in fact, we said, hopefully we can adopt one, maybe two. And we realized at that time, if you're willing to go across race, or if you're willing to adopt more than one at a time, or older kids, or special needs kids, you can get them a lot quicker.
That's beautiful. And we're seeing these beautiful photos of your family right now. And as you mentioned, you and your wife did adopt children from various backgrounds and ethnicities. Can you speak to what your experience of specifically interracial adoption has been like for your family?
Absolutely no difference whatsoever, Catherine. Initially, I got from the supposed experts that if we were to adopt a child outside of our race, we were going to have cultural issues. Well, those never came to pass because those children were our children. Mm. We were their mom and their dad, and we were not going to overthink the idea that one may have had more pigment in their skin than I do. And that's the way we approached it. Mm.
As you and your wife discerned adoption, did you have any personal fears or hesitations about moving forward with it? And what advice, Dr. Ray, might you have for a viewer who has those hesitations or misconceptions right now?
I'll draw a parallel to young people who say, I don't think I want to have children. I look at other children and I'm just not moved by them. And then they have a child, and all of a sudden this child is on Facebook every 6 minutes. They underestimate how this child can crawl underneath your heart. Same thing with adoption. Well, I don't know. Do you think I'll be able to love a child that's not biologically mine? Yes, of course you can. Because in the main, that child becomes real. It's abstract before you adopt. But once that child is with you, that is your child completely. Now, the other thing that's a benefit here, Catherine, and I share this with you, we found this out about the fourth kid. If you adopt in December, you still get the tax deduction for the whole year, you know? They paid for themselves that first year, right? I didn't pay any taxes.
That is some good insight right there, some good top advice. I'm curious on your answer to this question. Could you address, should every family consider adoption, particularly families struggling with infertility, for example, or is adoption truly a calling that a family needs to have and discern? What are your thoughts on that?
Some people will say, well, I don't feel called to adopt. Fair enough. But our Lord did say that this is our faith. They take care of the widows and the orphans in their distress. And he did say, whoever welcomes a little child welcomes me. So for Christians, it ought to be something we seriously consider, even if we've even had our own biological kids. Mm. Now, all that said, you got to take into consideration the state of your marriage, your finances, your age, your personality, your temperament. Mm-hmm. My wife said to me when we got the kid number 5 or 6, and we thought we were done, you know, 5 or 6, that's a pretty good load. Mm-hmm. We'd have to buy a bigger car. She said, Ray, if not us, who? We have a good marriage. We have a good extended family. We've got the resources. We're not rich, but we have enough money to support a family. So if not us, who? So it's kind of like, Catherine, it's kind of like eating potato chips, you know? We kept eating chips until we got a bellyache.
And now I bet you can't imagine your life without those children, those sons and daughters of yours. And Dr. Ray, of course, you have this professional lens as well, and on top of your personal perspective, because you are a clinical psychologist and you've written a number of books on adoption. What is your top advice as a psychologist that families should keep in mind if considering adoption?
My top advice as a psychologist is don't pay too much attention to the psychologists. We have scared adopted parents. Mm. We make them feel as though this child has got to be handled differently than a biological child that's yours. We make them overthink. We make them overanalyze. We make them look for psychological issues that may or may not be there. Mm. I tell parents right out of the gate, this is your child. Mm. Raise this child with the love and the discipline that you would raise any child that is yours. Quit overthinking it, because overthinking can oftentimes be the very thing that causes the trouble.
Mm. And you don't want to fall into just a spirit of fear over this. Dr. Ray, any specific advice for Catholics navigating adoption agencies? Anything they should particularly keep an eye out for or keep in mind there?
It's tougher now, Catherine, than it used to be. When we adopted some 30 years ago, if you were willing to adopt across race, you could adopt tomorrow. Well, now the number of children available for adoption is dramatically less. Mm. And oftentimes these kids are at risk. They've been drug or alcohol exposed in the womb. They're from overseas institutions. They are older and they've been in multiple foster care placements. So these are kids that have had a tough time biologically in the womb and shortly thereafter. And I tell parents, brace yourself in case the kids give you a bumpier time growing up. That can happen. But you're still there as the parent. Some of my kids have been dramatically drug exposed. Mm-hmm. And as a result, it took them a lot harder to form a conscience. They were slower in developing. Okay, that's my kid. That's who I'm going to deal with. Yeah. I recognize that. If they steal something from a drugstore, I'm going to deal with it. Mm. We bring it back. We handle it. We take care of it. I don't run screaming into the woods because they committed some behavior that I think, oh, no, are they going to be on Springer now 22 years ahead? Mm. So that's the one thing I would tell parents. If you're going to jump into this, wonderful. Just know that if you have some turbulence in the child growing up, that's to be expected. And that's why you're there.
Well, that is some great advice. Dr. Ray, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And if you'd like to hear more from Dr. Ray Guarendi, he brings his professional psychologist advice to EWTN News Nightly next week. He'll tell us how to have hard conversations during the holidays on the EWTN News Nightly Thanksgiving special next Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Join us again the week after Thanksgiving for news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.